Tonight's Taking Notes podcast is brought to you by none other than Collaboration University. With two technical events in July for Lotus Quicker and Same Time, and two more in September for Lotus Notes and Domino 8, Collaboration University is the place to be if you're responsible for preparing, deploying, or managing these technologies. Come to Collaboration University for the experience and get an education in the process. Join Mike Roden, Ken Bisconti, Ed Brill, and your IBM business partner producers and experts by registering at www.collaborationuniversity.com. That's www.collaborationuniversity.com. Visit the website for more information on dates and topics today. It's time for the Taking Notes podcast with Julian Robichaud and Bruce Elgort.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another highly mobile edition of the Taking Notes podcast. It's Tuesday, May 8th, 2007. My name is Bruce Elgort, and I am here with the highly mobile
Julian Robichaud, and I am here with Mr. Mobility himself,
Rob Wunderlich, talking to you from the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan.
All right, how about those red dogs?
No, Red Wings.
Red Wings. Yeah, that's
good, Julian.
Julian, you don't get out much, do you?
Oh no, I don't.
We just lost the 7 listeners we have in Detroit.
All right. Well, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, and out in the studio audience right now, Rob, give us the 2-minute Rob Wunderlich. Who are you, and why are you here?
Well, I have been working with Notes and Domino for about a decade and a half. I literally started back in the R2 days working with at that time a Lotus business partner in the Detroit area. And as of November of 2006, I actually got assimilated by the Borg and I went to work directly for IBM itself. But you guys are joking obviously about the mobility part, but one of the things that I had been doing a lot of was helping my customers get applications, Domino applications, delivered down to handheld devices, cell phones and PDAs and things like that. Upon my arrival at IBM, I've actually sort of taken a step up, and although I'm still working some with Notes and Domino, actually taking a look at a lot of stuff that's happening in the emerging technology area, Web 2.0, web services, a lot of those kind of things. I am I'm lost in a sea of acronym soup, which is good on some days and incredibly confusing on the other when you run into acronyms for which there are multiple answers. But we will persevere, I think. But anyway, so I'm an IBMer now, but had been working with a business partner, two different business partners for over 15 years prior to that.
Well, you know, let's go ahead and kick off with mobility, even though that's not necessarily your daily paycheck anymore. Let's start by that, because I know that a lot of people right now, when they think of when they think of mobile, they only think of BlackBerry. And you were doing this, really way before BlackBerry, right? You're talking about just almost sort of Joe cell phones that simply have internet connections, right?
Oh, absolutely, and I think that what's interesting is that I think that it's sort of swinging back a little bit to that. I've had some conversations with one of the guys that is one of the lead architects at IBM of the Domino Web Access product. And it's interesting. I mean, all of a sudden now that, as you say, I'm not really doing that for my daily paycheck, I've actually now gotten through to some of the people, and they are now talking. There's going to be a change to the Domino Web Access template, and it will now be accessible by the web browser on a handheld device. So the typical web browser that you have on a typical cell phone today will be able to get to your Domino Web Access mail. But to answer your question, yes, absolutely. I had been working with this for quite a while. And one of the things that people don't realize is that if you were in a Microsoft environment, you had an Exchange server, a SharePoint server, and if you had Windows Mobile on the device, then there's an awful lot of stuff that just works. If you're in a Domino environment, or if you're working with a Palm operating system on the device or a Symbian operating system on the device, it doesn't just work. And so there were a number of vendors that, you know, I had been working with, the Common Times, the IntelliSyncs, and some of those kind of people. The iAnywhere guys, a number of those kind of products that were out there that were helping to deliver these applications. And you're right, that was all above and beyond what was happening within BlackBerry. One of the reasons the BlackBerry story became rather compelling was that BlackBerry owned the entire infrastructure, which is to say they owned the server, they owned the transmission, they owned the device, they owned the sync, they owned everything. And because of that, the BlackBerry was pretty idiot-proof, and I mean that in a good sense, but if you were going to deploy a whole bunch of devices to a bunch of relatively non-technical sales guys, for example, frankly, BlackBerry was a great answer because it was pretty hard for those guys to blow it up. If any of you that may have dealt with either Windows Mobile or Palm devices, and you're trying to sync it back, and all you have to do is fat finger your password or do this or that or the other thing, and all of a sudden it doesn't work and it doesn't sync and you don't know why. And the IT department from the company has to pay a visit to the device and on and on and on, and it really becomes kind of a headache. And BlackBerry solved that. Now, they solved it rather nicely in the Domino world, particularly for mail and calendaring. They didn't solve it particularly well as far as getting applications beyond just mail and calendar and so on. And one of the things that's kind of interesting is that with the release of BlackBerry Server 4X and with the release of Domino Server 7X, all of a sudden the web services capability in Domino was able to be used by the designer client in BlackBerry Server, and all of a sudden you were able to access web services and deliver an application that way to a BlackBerry. So anyway, the bottom line is there's a lot of different ways you can do it, and right now I think you're going to find that there's going to be some browser-based applications for these devices. There's going to still be the Common Times and so on of the world that will have the ability to bring applications down, and then of course you have stuff happening in the BlackBerry. So it's pretty exciting, and there's obviously been quite a bit of consolidation happening. Good got bought by Motorola, IntelliSync got bought, etc. But what's kind of cool about it is that actually means that now there's some resources behind some of these little companies, and it probably bodes well for them staying in business. So it would be kind of interesting to see what happens over the course of the next year, 18 months, as all this begins to sort of settle out, and you have the goods of the world now beginning to play in the Domino world, and they're getting ready to start doing custom application support and stuff like that as well. So anyway, there's a lot happening there. And yeah, I was doing that for a long time. I was looking back. I'm going to be doing some presentations at the admin and Lotus developer conferences, and I actually have done delivering Domino to handheld devices at one or the other of those two for like 5 years, which I think definitely would put me in the ahead of the curve category.
Man, well, now there's a lot of different ways that you can do that. I'm sure you've probably spoken about a lot of those different techniques at your different sessions. One of the kind of the classic ways of putting Domino and Notes applications on a mobile device has been Domino EveryPlace. Is that still around? Is that something that you've used in the last 5 years?
Domino EveryPlace still exists. But it had been, it hadn't been sunsetted by IBM, but it has been, I don't know what the right word is, set out to pasture. So the product is still available, but it has not been revved recently. And so my suspicion is that you might have some issues with some of the, the newer versions of Domino. I mean, I think that was an R6 product. And so yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if that's going to work with R8 at all.
Right. Well, I was going to say at least R6, if not even R5, because I remember, I guess looking at some demos of that, way back when.
But for a while, I think that the IBM folks, and I can say this in sort of third party here, I think the IBM folks that were working with the pervasive products, they were trying to talk everybody up into the Webs for Every Place Access product, which, you know, and I mean this in the kindest of terms, but that was a beast of a product if all you really wanted to do was deliver mail and calendar out to 20 sales guys. I mean, yeah. It was incredibly expensive. It was very complex. And, you know, if what you really wanted to do was have people be able to access DB2 back end on, you know, some kind of very funky device, it was a great product. But if what you really wanted to do was just get notes mail out there, it was very complicated. You know, it was the old using a sledgehammer to do a thumbtack kind of kind of issue again. So, yeah. You know, I think that there were, at the time that a lot of that was going on, I think some of the other third-party products were probably better solutions. And again, as I mentioned, that's where the iAnywheres and the Common Times and some of these guys come into play.
Yeah, well, now, if I'm going to start developing today some mobile applications then, and I'm not BlackBerry specific, I think BlackBerry definitely has, you know, a development path to go down from the Domino perspective. But, you know, let's say that I need to support several mobile devices in my environment. Do I want to go really start looking at browser-based, or do I want to look at web services?
You could do either, and the real question is, do you want the information to live on the device, or is browser access okay? If you say browser access is okay, that's probably a much easier route to go, because it becomes just a normal HTTP sort of development environment. It just needs to be little. You know, I mean, it by that I mean screen size as well as sort of depth. I mean, you can't... You get into issues, and we don't need to go off on a total tangent here, but you get into issues not only about just the fact that most of those screens are, you know, what, even the best of these devices is 2.5 inches by 2.5 inches, something like that,
yeah,
per screen. But you then get into issues about, like, how do you scroll around and how do you input? And, you know, if I'm on a regular cell phone, I don't want to have to start entering a whole lot of text into a field. So, you know, there are issues of depth, issues of size, both directions. But I do think that that is probably an easier road for most Domino developers to be able to do sort of a mini HTML version. And there's things that you could do on the way in, and you can even do it with style sheets and stuff, so that, you know, if you come in with a regular browser, you get one look. You come in with one of these micro browsers and you get a different look. But that said, if what you really want to do is get the information down to the device, and have it there so that your information is available to you when you are, as they say, out of service, then, you know, you're going to need to do something where you can actually bring it down. And I think web services might be the answer right now, because that seems to be more ubiquitous in terms of working with more different types of devices.
Well, weren't there some products, you know, over the years that allowed you to take, like, your notes applications offline on some of these, you know, the Pylon. Remember the Pylons of the world and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. Well, and Pylon is what became iAnywhere. So, yes, I know it well. But the issue that you have is that Pylon, for example, now, and keep in mind, Pylon is sort of the grandfather to the current products. But Pylon was a great product, but you could do one form and one view.
It's been a long time. But, yeah, I think I do recall that.
Yeah, and Common Time has a product called mForms, and it works great for Windows Mobile, but it doesn't work for Palm. It doesn't work for Symbian. Mm. You know, so it's sort of like there's a bunch of good solutions, but there isn't really one solution that works all the way across the board. So it becomes a situation where a company needs to take a hard look at that, and what do we really want to do? What kind of devices are going to support that? And then let's standardize on it, and then we know what the product is we're going to need to do to help deliver that down to the devices.
Mm-hmm. If my memory serves me correctly, I think Eric Mack may have blogged something about posing the same question. If I find the blog entry he talked about it, I'll put it in the show notes. Do any of you guys remember that post? No? Where Eric was exploring running apps on, you know, a Windows Mobile device?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what it was, though.
Yeah, I forgot.
We'll find it.
And it rings a bell with me as well, and I don't recall it.
See, Eric, you know, we take so much away from your blog, you know. No, only kidding. Hey, guys, I think now would be a good time to hear from Mr. Chris Blatnick again.
Well, I've been hoping you could.
What was that, Rob?
I was hoping we could hear from Chris.
Yeah, actually.
You've been asking.
You've had too much mud pie tonight. Now, Rob is laughing because I started the podcast recording 15 minutes too early. Julian wasn't around. I called Rob and I asked him what time the podcast was, and he was saying that it was in another 15 minutes, and if he could take those 15 minutes to enjoy, a Trader Joe's mud pie. So he's high on caffeine and chocolate right now. So, Rob, you'll say anything, right?
Yeah, you got it.
Rob, you've listened to all 60 episodes of the podcast, too, right?
61, I think, up till now, isn't it?
All right. So, Chris Blatnick of Interface Matters talking about usability testing. Take it away, Mr. Blatnick.
Hey, everybody. This is Chris Blatnick from InterfaceMatters.com, and welcome to my second segment on the Taking Notes podcast. Evidently, there wasn't enough hate mail in the mailbag last time, so Bruce and Julian asked me to come back. And I'm happy to be here this time to talk a little bit about a part of the design process that's not often used in notes development, at least in places I've been over my career. And I think it's a really important aspect of design, and that's usability testing. So in this segment, I'm going to discuss a little bit about usability testing, what it is at a high level, and then the next time, we'll look at how you can actually perform some, let's say, bargain basement usability testing. You don't have to have all kinds of fancy equipment and two-way mirrors, and if the thoughts of usability testing conjure up these incredible laboratories in your mind, those are great, but if you don't have that, you can still do usability testing, and it's a phenomenal tool to have in your toolbox. So let's take a look a little bit at usability testing. What is it? What it's all about? Basically, it's a process of testing how well people can actually use the software that you've developed. So it's quite a bit different from maybe traditional testing methods that you use today that you would still use in conjunction with usability testing. It's not a method for testing whether or not the application or the program you've built is actually outputting information correctly or storing data in the back end correctly. It's a method to test as a designer whether or not you've made your application simple to use, whether or not you've made it easy to understand, and that the program actually allows the user to do their job quickly and efficiently. So with that kind of short definition, you can see that all the traditional unit testing and QA and all those things that you do today don't really address any of those aspects, the softer aspects of usability. And is this application something that's going to delight my user and make their job easier? So in a usability test, what do you do? How does this proceed? What you basically do is you have a user in a room, and you give them a particular scenario to complete. And then you observe how they go about doing that. So this is a very key point of usability testing, observation. You're not going to just ask them, oh, so what do you think about this? Or, hey, this is the new functionality. Do you get it? Which is a lot of times how we test when we roll an application out. But that's not really going to help you uncover the errors that are inherent in your design from a usability standpoint. So it's very, very important to observe the user in their, let's say, natural setting where they're actually working with the application to find out what the problems are. Also, make sure you don't confuse usability testing with focus groups or market research. Sometimes people incorrectly, interchangeably use those terms, but focus groups and market research are the things that you kind of do up front to find out what people want out of your application, but that's not what you use to find out if your application is actually usable. So what do we do in a usability test? Well, we sit down, we observe the user doing a particular task, and again, it's a scenario-based task that we give them. So let's say we have a very simple example is we have a screen in front of the user, and there's two fields and a button, and the user has to put a numeric value in the first field, a numeric value in the second field. They press the button, and the computer should give them a sum of those two numbers, let's say. So the usability test is concerned with whether or not the user can actually put a number in the first field, put a number in the second field, click the button, and get some kind of result. Of course, with usability testing, we don't care what that result is. If they put 2 plus 2 and they get 5, that'll be uncovered in other kinds of testing. In the usability test, we're concerned with, was the user able to successfully complete the scenario? Were they able to correctly put the numbers in the field and press the button? Did they figure that out? So we use usability testing to uncover all the problems that users have with the design before it's released to production. So you do the scenario with multiple users, ideally, at least 5, let's say. And after testing, then you go back and you pour through all of these notes that you've taken. And that's, again, very important. You observe the user and you record all of their actions and problems in notes. What you're looking for is the major problems, the patterns of inconsistency, slight confusion, those kind of things. And the resulting notes that you get then allow you to construct a picture of the errors that are completely glaringly obvious. And a lot of times, even better, I think, is you uncover some of the subtle things where users had issues, or you uncover areas of improvement or ways that you can definitely make your design a lot better. So once you've got that clear understanding of the things that were broken and the things that can be improved, you sit down with your design and you work to fix it. So basically, you go back to the drawing board at this point and fix those glaringly obvious errors, make those subtle improvements, and then you'll test again. So a lot of times when I discuss usability testing, people ask, well, when should I do it? I do it at the very end of the project, right? Well, you should do it at the end, but ideally, you should really do usability testing as soon as you have a low-fidelity prototype. And if you follow my blog or if you've seen me at some of the conferences recently, you know that I talk about low-fidelity prototyping quite a bit, or paper prototyping. This is one of the great tools of design as well, is to build your application on paper before you actually write any code. And the easiest problems to fix are those that haven't been coded yet. So if you can test your low-fidelity prototype or your paper prototype, then you'll find all those errors before you've written a single lick of code, and you'll save yourself a lot of time and money. So basically, I advocate doing a paper prototype and then sitting down with the users and actually testing this prototype. And again, next time, we'll talk about some of the techniques that allow you to test with a paper prototype. There's huge value in doing this. Don't forget then that usability testing should be an iterative process. And you should conduct this at least a couple times in your design process. Ideally, do it right away when you have a low fidelity prototype. Maybe you've made a second or third iteration and you're going to test during that third iteration. Then you start writing your code, and you'll probably then do another usability test after you've got an actual electronic prototype. So if you do this process 2 or 3 times, you are going to uncover most of those problems from a usability standpoint, from a user experience standpoint, before that thing ever gets rolled out to production. And it's a really great feeling when you can roll that out, knowing that you've done the best you can in terms of getting that user experience as perfect as you possibly can. So I encourage you definitely to go out and learn more about usability testing. I'll have some resources for you next time. I plan to do a series of articles on my blog as well, so keep an eye out for that. And if you have any questions, you know where to find me, chris@interfacematters.com. Thanks, everyone. Talk to you next time.
Thanks, Chris. That was a great piece on usability testing, and we appreciate your participation in the show, and I'm sure the listening audience, the highly mobile listening audience, does as well.
Hi, my name is Mike Smith, and I'm from the Turtle Partnership. We're one of the business partners behind Collaboration University, and I'd like to take a little time just to talk to you about our events that are coming up in July. Well, what we're going to be running is a highly focused technical coverage of Quicker, Same Time, and Quick Place. And this is going to be presented by the leading experts. These are the guys who wrote the red books and who write the exams on Same Time and Quick Place, including such guys as Chris Miller, Carl Tyler, Rob Novak, and of course, my colleague, Gabriella Davis. Not only that, but IBM Lotus have given us some fantastic support. The strategy keynotes are going to be presented by Mike Rodin, Ken Bisconti, and Ed Brill at our events. And we're very pleased and excited that they're doing this for us. And not only that, from IBM Lotus as well, is Satwik Seshasai, who is the development manager of Quicker, will be coming along to our event, our first set of events in July, as well as Mark Peigne, who is the senior project manager for team collaboration at IBM Lotus. We're very pleased to have them along, and to get them to this sort of event is just fantastic. Right. The first event, as I said, is coming up in July, and this is going to be Collaboration University for Quicker and Same Time. Also, as I say, covering off Quick Place there as well. And there's going to be a lot of deep dive technical and training sessions, along with there's going to be this time as well, following feedback from our Collaboration University event last year, there's also going to be really hands-on workshops on a whole range of issues that we think are going to work very, very well again this year. And you can see about them and about our upcoming events on our website, which is www.collaborationuniversity.com. I'd just like to add something else. Julian, in the last podcast, mentioned that we're running this event in both Kansas City and also in London. And London, which you may get an idea that I'm actually standing on when I'm making this presentation to you, is also the site of the Collaboration University Hotel, which is going to be the Radisson Edwardian Marlborough, which is a great hotel and also surprisingly affordable. And not only that, hey, most of the other hotel chains are within easy walking distance, and it's slap bang in the middle of central London. And you could actually throw a stone and hit the British Museum, which I don't really advise. So please come and join us. It's going to be one hell of an event, and we'd really like to see you there. Thank you very much.
No. All right, where did we leave off with Rob here?
I know I wasn't paying attention. I hope you were taking notes.
This is the
taking notes.
You know how many Google hits we get for taking notes? And actually, the podcast site is the number one hit on Google for the phrase "taking notes." So
yes, and there have to be a lot of very disappointed high school and college students that end up on our site for one reason or another.
Yeah
it's second only to Cliff's notes, probably.
All right, Rob. So. Rob, you're now an evangelist, right?
I am. I don't have the white suit yet, but I've certainly got the white hair, so I'm working on the look.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what you're doing in your new role and how, you know, what does all this Web 2.0 stuff, you know, mean to, you know, domino shops that are out and about?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I got hired by IBM to work in an area that is particularly unusual within the IBM Corporation, in that I'm in software group, but I actually have nothing to sell. And I got to be one of the few people in the software group that actually can say that, because obviously that software group is supposed to be selling stuff. But the issue that my group is dealing with, I'm under the overall umbrella of software standards and emerging technologies, and that's where the Web 2.0 and some of that stuff comes in. But the software standards is what we're really trying to sell. And I can sort of give an example of this really quickly. buddy of mine was saying, I said, what is the whole deal with the software standards? I said, it's mostly real simple. You know how I can send you an email, and I could be a Lotus Notes guy, and you could be on Yahoo Mail, or you could be on Gmail, or you could be an Exchange guy, or you could be whatever it is that you are, but you could, you'll get the mail, and it'll work, and then return receipts will work, and all that kind of stuff will work. And the guy goes, yeah, I know that. No big deal. I said, okay. But what if I sent you a calendar invitation? And the guy says, well, those never work. Exactly. And that's software standards at work. The mail side of the house, everybody's agreed on the standards, and everybody has standardized on what the to field is and the from field and return receipt requested and all that kind of stuff. It's all standards all the way across the board. It's all nailed down. Everybody's happy. On the calendar side, it isn't quite as clean, and there are different people doing different things, and there are different factions still fighting for their own standards and so on. And so part of what my group is trying to do is try to help sort of evangelize about those standards and try to work with not only within our own product groups, but also try to work with some of the standards bodies and IBM. I forget the number off the top of my head, but I think we are sitting on 49 different standards bodies out in the world. And I think of the 49, I think we actually are chairing 14 different standards committees and things like that. But it ranges every place from, you know, the WC3 and some of these kind of, you know, great big organizations down to some of the industry ones. The thing that I find kind of intriguing is, in addition to the industry standards that you have at the, you know, overall software level, then you have industry standards for like particular industries. So retail, for example, or pharmaceuticals or insurance, and some of these kind of guys, they also have technology standards that get applied to their software. So if you want to sell an insurance package to somebody, you have to make sure that it talks the insurance standards as well as talking whatever the bigger picture is. So, you know, that becomes a very important discussion. And one of the women in our organization put it very succinctly. I mean, we don't actually sell standards. That is to say, we don't sell a thing called the standard. But we sell a lot of products that support those standards. And because of that, the products are more compatible with more different things out in the world. They're more extensible. And as you guys, I think, know pretty well, most all the stuff now is becoming more and more open software so that, again, not like all the new Domino stuff is coming out and it's all built on the Eclipse platform, which is an open standard. And it means that it's extensible. Normal human beings now have the ability to create plugins that will work with the Notes client or work with the SameTime client. And that becomes pretty exciting stuff. As far as how Web 12 fits into that, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish. No, please.
As far as how Web 2.0 fits into that, I find it kind of intriguing because people keep thinking about Domino now as being one of these legacy, been around forever, and it doesn't do all the fun new stuff kind of products. And frankly, nothing could be further from the truth. And Julian, as you well know, since you're also doing some sessions at the admin / Lotus Developer conference coming up in June.
Oh, yeah.
You know, web services are supported. You know, you can do Ajax front ends. You can do all kinds of cool stuff. And in fact, even if you just take a look at the Domino Web Access template, there's a whole lot of Ajax stuff going on with that template today. And it's simple things like when you hit page down, it doesn't do a round trip back to the server. Now, we used to call that dynamic HTML, but what it basically means, it's an asynchronous thing, and it's bringing up the pages kind of under the hood. So every time you hit page down, it doesn't mean that it takes a complete round trip back to the server just to bring you the next 30 documents. So there's a lot of stuff like that that's going on, and it's really exciting, and it's one of these things where there's a cool new thing to learn every hour of every day, and it's been a lot of fun. In the past 6 months, I've just learned a tremendous amount of new stuff about all these, again, all these new standards and new services, and it's sort of like my sandbox has gotten a lot larger. I got a lot of new toys to play with.
All right, now let me pull you back to the whole calendar thing for a second. Now, you know, when you talk about standards and how there's not really a good calendar standard. Why isn't everyone just using iCal? I don't get that.
Well, all right, your point's well taken. There is a standard. It just has not been as widely adopted as the, you know, the male standards had been. And I don't know why that is either. I mean, I could probably, you know, call somebody at Google and ask them, but it is interesting because Microsoft and IBM do seem to have that worked out. And if you have an exchange shop send a invitation to a Domino shop and vice versa, it will basically work. But, you know, don't send one to, from either of those, don't send one to Yahoo because it will never end up in their Yahoo calendar.
Yeah. Well, now I will tell you that when people have sent me calendar invitations from Notes 8 to my Gmail account, that it's worked flawlessly. I get just the regular calendar invite, and I get buttons for reply. Do you want to attend? Yes, no. You can decline. You can accept. It'll go straight on your Google calendar. So they, at least in Notes 8, it works. I think in 6 and 7. The functionality still isn't quite right, but in 8, they seem to have done a really good job with that.
Yeah, I think in 7, I think you got a file attachment or something that you had to then click on, and it wasn't. Alan Leposky, I think, has done multiple entries about how to work correctly.
Yeah, I think it's like an ICS attachment or something like that. So
yeah, but again, the point is that it's those kind of standards that begin to make all this stuff work. I mean, I sort of think about sports as the, a comparison. I mean, when somebody goes out for the Olympic medal in, swimming, right? How big's the pool? How wide are the lanes? How deep is it? There's standards. And I started chasing that one day, and the NCAA, for example, has a standards book for diving and swimming. And it talks about all that kind of, I mean, it literally even has the temperature of the pool. I mean, they don't want the temperature to be particularly high or particularly low. That standards book for the NCAA for swimming and diving is 154 pages long. Hmm. And that's like specifications of the pool. So this is where, again, there's standards everywhere, but that's why when somebody, sets a new record for swimming, it means something because they know that the pool was exactly 65.3 meters long, or I'm making that up, but whatever the dimension is, because all the pools have to be the exact same length. Just like, all of the calendar messages have to have the exact same specs, exact same standards behind them. So that's what we've been doing a lot of, and it's really fascinating stuff. And what I'm going to be doing at the admin and developer conferences, we're going to talk about some of that stuff. Don't ask me why I agreed to do this, but I'm actually doing a session called the ABCs of SOA. And we're going to talk about the SOA, meaning service-oriented architecture, for anybody that doesn't know that acronym. Mm-hmm. And if you think you've been through acronym soup so far, you ain't seen nothing, baby. But this session is going to, we're going to talk about just a whole bunch of these different standards and how they apply and how web services works in the Domino world, as well as how it works in the outside world, and how Domino can play, and all that. And this young man, Julian something, is loaning me a demo database that's going to be very, very nice to work with. So,
hey, by the way, are you going to answer the question of what the simple in SOAP actually means? Because there's nothing simple about that.
Well, and I think even RSS, right? Really simple syndication. I don't think that one's simple either, frankly, but it does work. But
us tech guys, we tend to oversimplify everything,
so to speak.
Go ahead, Jim.
Go ahead, Bruce. No, Bruce, you.
No, you go ahead.
You.
Now it's Ocho de Mayo. You go.
I have nothing to say. It is you. You must speak.
No, I was going to ask you, what else you want to challenge Rob with here
turn it around and pretend like you're asking me a question. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, you know me too well. Now, actually, I've been doing a lot of work with Salesforce.com lately, and thanks to the help of Julian, Salesforce supports a lot of outbound messaging. Like when certain things occur in Salesforce, it can send an outbound, message to, say, my Domino server, which is sitting there listening, you know, a web service is listening, takes in the, you know, the web service information, and then I can go off and do some Domino stuff. And in my particular instance, I shove it back to Salesforce after Domino's done with it. But it's great stuff. So
it is. And you know, I think for anybody that's not, I mean, they've heard the term web services and they aren't really clear on exactly what that means. Julian, I'm actually using one of your definitions in my presentation, but Julian said it's really machine-to-machine conversation, and that's really what it amounts to. It's like we're so used to a web thing where we have a browser as a person and we go hit a website, but web services is where basically a machine goes and, as you say, it issues something, or it either issues a request or it issues, you know, it has some kind of outbound messaging that gets read or answered on the other end, depending on which direction this thing is headed. But basically, it's the machines talking and, you know, answering questions or filling in blanks or issuing orders or whatever it might be. And it's very interesting stuff because it all sort of leads into the whole idea of, you know, how we can make some of these things work kind of autonomically. I mean, let's let the machines talk to each other and not have to have it be done in a batch agent that runs at midnight and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, let's go ahead and, you know, when a new purchase order is issued, let's have the inventory system know about that right away, and let's, you know, have purchasing know that this stuff is coming down the pipe and so on. And again, that whole idea of the service-oriented architecture begins to really make sense, and you begin to componentize these things, and instead of them, you know, being all their individual little silos, then start to have them talk to each other. And it's intriguing stuff. And Salesforce, of course, is kind of interesting because that becomes the whole idea of software as a service. I mean, you go to the Salesforce conference and they're all walking around with those buttons that say software and they got the big slash mark through them.
That's right, no software. But I don't want to go there right now because, like I said, I had, you know, Salesforce talking to my Domino servers to do certain things that the no software solution couldn't do. So it's not true. Software as a service is, you know, well, we won't go there right now.
It's not quite there yet.
Hey Rob, I had a question for you here. So where would someone see you evangelizing, you know, Lotus Software? I mean, you have a blog, right?
I do, yes. Domino Unplugged. And despite the fact that, as we have already already put out there for the world, I'm not day-to-day still in the mobile world. I still certainly am more than casually interested in what happens with the mobile stuff with Domino. So dominounplugged.com is the website, mm-hmm. which incidentally, I rolled it over right at the first of the year to the new Domino blog template in R7, which you won't recognize when you look at my site, thanks to Sean Burgess, who helped me do some very nice customizations to that template. Mm-hmm. But as far as evangelizing, I actually was just out at there's a Web 2.0 Expo out in San Francisco at the beginning of this month, and I was out there for a couple of days. I will be in June, beginning of June, I'll be at the Admin and Lotus Developer Conference, and probably some other things at the moment, but that's the only thing that is that I actually have tickets for, so we'll see how the other things pan out as we get closer.
Right. Yeah. Now, with a job like that, with, you know, kind of the evangelist title, is that something where you can really plan things for more than about 2 weeks in advance, or do they just kind of give you a call and say, okay, you need to be somewhere tomorrow?
It seems to be a little bit of both. At least for the time being, a lot of my role is more like conference oriented. And so, obviously, those things you know about some time in advance. There's one of the other guys on my team that basically is a paratrooper, and he has no clue where he's liable to be, you know, next Monday, because it's exactly that kind of thing where he gets called into, you know, customer engagements and things like that, and so he gets, you know, he's flying all over the place. But my life isn't quite that chaotic at the moment, but it could get there. Who knows?
Do you bleed yellow?
I will bleed yellow forever. Despite the fact that I've been assimilated by Big Blue, I still bleed yellow, absolutely.
Yeah, actually, Chris Blatnick had a blog entry about that, I think, about evangelizing notes, you know, Lotus notes and Domino stuff. So we'll Well, we'll point everyone to that because it was a great read. All right, so we talked about a lot of things today. Julian, do we want to ask Mr. Wunderlich anything else, or are we on to better things?
Well, I'll tell you what, Rob, we've got your website link on the podcast notes, and so if people need to get in touch with you, I'm guessing they can find you through the website. And you said you've got a lot of things coming up in the next couple of weeks. So, if people want to come and meet you, then they can certainly come and say hi and find out what it's like to be an evangelist and talk about, how you've changed their lives, right?
Hey, we'll go white suit shopping together.
Ah, very good. Well, Rob, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much for making some time for us, especially so late at night. Because I'm in the same time zone as you are, so I know it's a little bit tough to work that in during the day, but hopefully you can count these as billable hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, the good idea! I hadn't thought of that. I'll absolutely do that. Thanks, guys, and it has been a pleasure, and hope to see not only you guys but also anybody that's listening in Boston for that conference. Julian will be there as well, and Julian, as I say, is doing the hard part of my presentation where I get 5,000-foot overview, and he's doing the hard stuff showing you how the code works. So that's going to be a lot of fun, too. So I look forward to seeing you guys there.
All right. Outstanding.
All right, everyone. It's time for me to eat dinner. I know you guys ate dinner already. Chris Blatnick, thanks for another great Interface Matters or Taco Matters. we'll explain that in another podcast. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in to episode 61 of the Taking Notes podcast. We'll catch you real soon. And Rob, thank you again.
Go Red Wings.
All right. Go Red Wings. All right. Take care.
That's right. It's time for your Collaboration University pop quiz. Put your thinking caps on, and if you have the first correct answer, you can win fabulous prizes, fame, and fortune. So here's this week's pop quiz question. What two companies were purchased to make what we know today as Lotus Same Time? Email your response to popquiz@collaborationuniversity.com. That's popquiz@collaborationuniversity.com. All prizes, fame, and fortune are figurative and may be substituted for mention on the next Taking Notes podcast.